Brad Card, one of our political analysts and all-stars, Card and Associates out of D.C., keeps a close watch on Congress for us in the White House. But, Brad, we'll start locally with you for a moment because you know the landscape well here. We just had one of the Democrats running for governor, Cindy Warmington, live on the show to kick off the 9 o'clock hour. She's an executive counselor, as you know, Democrat running. Her main challenger is Joyce Craig. And it's going to be a pretty serious primary, but they Warmington and Craig have been trying to engage Kelly Ayotte more than they have each other, Brad, which is not unusual. But I finally asked Cindy Warmington her thoughts on Joyce Craig. How do you differentiate yourself, and what kind of job do you think she did as mayor of Manchester? Sort of the first shot or salvo of this primary batch. She said, well, I'm not going to really, but I will say it's interesting. After she was mayor, the Republican won the mayor's race, and the Republicans won the board there, and I'll leave it at that. So what's the strategy here, and how do you see, because, you know, Chuck Morris, Kelly Ayotte, the main Republicans, how do you see this governor's, sort of the primaries unfolding, and, you know, kind of who has the upper hand here, do you think?
Yeah, well, so I think Kelly Ayotte has the upper hand, certainly in the Republican side for governor, and to win the primary. I think I would give her the odds-on favorite chance to win that. I think the Democrats are going to have to be defending Joe Biden. Polling suggests in New Hampshire that the president is going to beat Donald Trump. And so Kelly Ayotte, presumably, if she's the Republican nominee, is going to have to outperform Donald Trump in order to get elected. That it's going to be a fine line for someone who's in a state like New Hampshire, that Donald Trump is not as popular as he is in certain other states, but he's still very popular amongst the base, walking that fine line. And Democrats are going to have to do a similar thing. You know, Chris Pappas has pushed against the president over his southwest border policy. I've said it's been a disaster. If you look at polling, it suggests that President Biden is upside nationally significant. His job approval rating, he's upside down 17%. Right track, wrong track. When you look at the right track versus the wrong track, he's upside down by 41.8%, almost 42%. Those numbers are horrible for the president, absolutely abysmal. So Democrats are going to be forced by the Republicans to defend the president's policies, specifically on the southwest border, which has been a disaster, even according to the Chris Pappases of the world. So if you're in the majority, you're a Democrat, your president is a Democrat, what are you doing to put pressure on him, and why aren't you able to get him to change his policies? That's a reasonable question that voters will be asking.
Yeah, and it's a tough spot. It'll be interesting. This state's going to be hard to understand because even though we have a smaller number of electoral college votes, they might matter in a tight race, and it's really the independent voters here, Brad, that are going to swing and make a difference. And it's hard to tell right now where they're going to swing to, what side of the seesaw. It's almost impossible. Right now, you would think you would think right now Joe Biden has New Hampshire in the bag. You would think there's no question that Trump would do well in New Hampshire against Biden based on recent elections, right? But then Biden came up here right after the State of the Union. Joe Biden followed that. They seem concerned about New Hampshire.
Look at Joe Biden flipped off the state of New Hampshire, in my opinion, and he walked away from the First in the Nation primary, along with the National Democrat Party. That should send chills to Democrats, in my opinion, and it should send chills to voters in New Hampshire that they're willing to walk away from the First in the Nation primary status that New Hampshire has so admirably held, and have been a real leader the rest of the country. You've seen Jeanne Shaheen and Maggie Hassan push back against the DNC and against the president on that, but unsuccessfully. So now you've got a situation where you've got independent voters who don't like Donald Trump, and I think we do know a direction where independent voters are going, at least historically, and it's not for a Trump candidate. We saw the most Trumpy of candidates win the Republican primary in congressional districts, the primaries and in the last United States Senate race, and they got beat badly. So I think that we know that the independent voters are not necessarily embracing Trump, although I believe that they do like many of the policies that he's done. And those policies that they like are going to be front and center because Biden changed those policies through administrative action, through executive order. So I think the problem squarely lies at the feet of Joe Biden, especially on the southwest border. And there's been a tone deafness within the administration to make any changes. And that's just a fact. So I think that they're going to have their hands full. Democrats are going to have their hands full, but yeah. Republicans are going to have their hands full. And look, at abortion is a tough issue. I think that Kelly Ayotte's right to say the issue's been settled in New Hampshire. Chris Sununu has said that. It is settled in New Hampshire, but Democrats are going to talk about it, and that will get voters energized on the Democrat side of the aisle.
Let me, Brad Carter.
And on the independent side.
Let me switch gears. Donald Trump's, because we know it's Joe Biden and Vice President Harris. Donald Trump seems to be changing. And, of course, you know, there's time, and Trump's the marketing genius. I think even critics would have to concede that. So who knows what he's going to do. And I think it will be his decision, not advisors, who he wants to pick as running mate. But he seems to be favoring and spending more time with Doug Burgum, of course, the governor of North Dakota. I would think he might be a more apt or able energy secretary, and maybe a Tim Scott. A few weeks ago, you were hearing Marco Rubio. You were hearing other names, Tom Cotton, out of the Senate in Washington. But what are you? Do you have any inside baseball on what you're hearing on when and who it might be in the end?
I don't. I mean, Donald Trump likes to be liked, right? And he likes to have people sucking up to him. And that's what we've seen. I mean, to me, it's laughable that United States senators and members of Congress are going to his trial and holding their own press conferences to wave their flag of loyalty to Donald Trump. To me, that's pandering, and it's beneath the office, in my opinion. And I would argue Tim Scott is right on that pandering bandwagon, unfortunately, to become a running mate. I don't see that from Doug Burgum, like, as nearly as much as the others.
Well, the other thing I notice, a lot of people don't know, but Burgum was a co-founder of Great Western Software, Great Plains Software, which sold to Microsoft. And he's done very well. Great upbringing.
He did a great job as governor.
No, what I'm saying, he's done a great job as governor in terms of taxation and business in North Dakota. But, I mean, he's got a lot of money. And sometimes that makes a difference when you're sort of self-funding a presidential campaign, Brad.
Well, just be clear. Donald Trump is not self-funding.
Well, no. What I'm saying is his way of funding a campaign is different than Joe Biden's.
Look,
I mean, hold on. Let me just say this. The other day in New Jersey, Trump got almost 100,000 people at a rally in a blue state, and then of course they go to the fundraising machine, and a lot of the money he's raising is going to his legal bills. But Trump brings the crowds out. He's not a traditional campaigner. In the past, you would even send Brad years ago. It's about campaign organization and raising money. Trump really didn't do either when he won in 2016. He shows up and he gets the rallies, but
there's no question.
Joe Biden is more of a fundraising candidate, and I'm just saying sometimes it might be good to have a running mate who can write a $100 million check.
Yeah, my inclination is the campaign apparatus, if you will, for lack of a better word, is better on the Democrat side to get out the vote, to make sure people are going to show up at the polls. You know, nationally, it's probably better with Democrats, and that's what money is used for, right? Donald Trump's using his money to pay legal fees. Donald Trump said he was going to pay, self-fund his campaign. He didn't. So I think there's a whole lot of money side things. But Donald Trump's campaign, whether he gets elected or not, I don't think is going to be driven by money nearly as much, because Donald Trump is invoking passion. He's invoking passion amongst his supporters. They will walk through fire to go vote for him. And he's invoking passion on the other side of people that don't like Donald Trump and want to vote against him. I think Doug Burgum actually would bring the, if you will, Nikki Haley type voter, make them a little bit more soft, give them a little bit more of a serious tone, so that they would someone who might not otherwise vote for Donald Trump might vote for him. I don't think that would be the case with the others that you see in the race. I mean, you see J.D. Vance, who has been a sinker Trump fan and a very hard right person in the Senate. Elise Stefanik's taken a dead loyalist, approach to Donald Trump and called the people that were arrested on January 6th right. hostages and music. Tim Scott. I mean, all of this. But what I think that Doug Burgum does is he was a very serious candidate.
Right.
And I think that the Doug Burgum candidacy as a vice president would be a smart pick.
It doesn't have the splash factor that, you think Trump would do, but sometimes that backfires.
Well, you don't need it. I mean, Donald Trump has the splash factor himself.
You're right. He's the splash, right? So you don't need splash. Yeah, that's a good point. Kevin Forrest, the director of Manchester, the VA, the whole facility and all the stuff here locally, and he joins us with an update. And I always love having Kevin on because they're doing a ton. And he has the Lauren, who's the acting chief of mental health. And this is a big area I want to discuss because this is a growing area that we need to do a better job across the board, Kevin, to support our veterans on the mental health side. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jack. Boy, it's nice to be back in New Hampshire after being gone for a few weeks here. So
don't tell me you're already back. I thought you were gone for a month on that great in-house Virginia. You were doing some business leadership stuff for the VA?
I'll tell you, it was interesting to work with other agencies in the government and do that. But no, certainly good to be
that
back.
That went quickly.
I just want to say thanks. There's 12 hours for veterans. All of our community partners who help us take care of veterans and offering peer support and so many other things. It takes a village here to take care of everybody.
Well, listen, I want to thank you. I didn't realize you were back, Kevin. I know you had a good, serious, organizational stuff, but. You working with places like Veterans Count is a big part of it, too, so thank you. Let's talk mental health. Take it away, Kevin.
All right. Well, I would like to introduce to all the listeners today Lauren Gibo, who is our acting chief of mental health, and May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and whatever we can do to orient folks to the multiple services we have. So I'll let Lauren take it away.
Thank you, Lauren.
All right. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Jack. So I wanted to take a few minutes to kind of talk about the services we offer at the Manchester VA. So we offer a multitude of mental health services, both same-day services. We offer integrated services within primary care. We offer both individual and group therapy. We offer psychiatry services, medication management. We also have a marriage and family therapist. So we can see couples and families. We also offer peer support, suicide prevention services. We have specific programming for veterans who have experienced military sexual trauma. We have specialized services for veterans that are involved with the legal system and also veterans that are reentering the community post-incarceration. We also have robust substance use services, which is really wonderful in the state of New Hampshire. So we offer outpatient substance use services, and then we also partner with our other VAs within the VISN to offer residential treatment services. So I wanted to highlight those residential treatment services for a minute because they're really wonderful. It gives the opportunity for veterans to be with other veterans for, 4 to 6 weeks. They mm-hmm. often have a vocational component to them. They also offer evidence-based practices. They are all within New England. And then the nice thing is the coordination and collaboration between those sites and our sites is a well-greased wheel, really. We all share the same electronic medical record, so we're able to see exactly how the veteran's doing. Those staff have easy access to our staff, so mm-hmm. we've even provided, individual therapy for a veteran, so they're not losing any traction with their individual therapy while they're in residential treatment. We also offer a multitude of virtual care as well, so veterans can be seen, wherever they are. They don't have to come into the medical center. So that's really been, that's been wonderful. I myself have seen veterans while they're on their lunch break at work, or while they're at home if they're caring for their children or don't have transportation. So it's really pretty wonderful.
And Lauren and Kevin, you know, we have one of our healthcare advocates and sponsors, the folks, Jedock, help me out, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, the CEO, Maria Pru, has a very good line about, you know, mental health and, you know, anxiety, depression, and all the things of mental health. It should be part of primary care, not a secondary thing, you know, because if a person's not feeling well emotionally, mentally, then how can they be well physically? And I think if we can make it more of a primary care and integrate it like you are, that's really important.
Yeah, Jack, you know, I look at that whole, you know, VA effort of primary care mental health integration where, you know, a veteran needs to see, you know, a mental health professional and they can walk across the hall and have that integrated care here. And hey, that's what makes the VA so special.
I agree.
And I think...
go ahead, Lauren.
Oh, sorry, just to jump in, that's one of the things that I think is really unique about the VA. When I came here, they were already doing, we call them clinical reminders, but they're basically, you know, mental health screening in primary care. So veterans, when they come into a primary care appointment, are asked about their whole health, right? They're asked about, are they experiencing any depression or anxiety? So they don't even have to come in prepared to talk about it. We're going to ask and engage them in that conversation.
Good stuff.
You know, Jack, you know, it was interesting at this course I was at. So I was fortunate to meet the chief medical officer of a big VA medical center down south. And so naturally gravitated towards him and just talking about care for veterans. But, you know, it just made me think, you know, he's the recipient of a lot of our snowbirds who go down there in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just talked about how great it is to be able to have this one inclusive medical record where, you know, if I was to move down south for 6 months out of the year, that all my medical information is right at their fingertips to continue taking care of me. And I think that's something everybody needs to know and think about. It's the power of the VA.
Good point. Well, hey, good to have you back, Kevin. And Lauren, thanks for what you do. Kevin, you're welcome to check in tomorrow. You're always welcome as we go 12 hours. But thank you for giving us an update this morning. We'll catch you real soon. Kevin Forrest and Lauren with the Manchester VA and beyond. Thank you both.
Great. Thanks, Jack.
Author of a book that's coming out, Send Me the Story, the True Story of a Mother at War. And this is a really cool story. Because this is an unusual story about a woman who becomes an operator, which is very rare in the military, and then gets married to a special forces soldier. Marty's going to join us, but he also does year-round stuff for veterans. Now, this is a portrait of a brilliant warrior and her unlikely path to the front line. Patriotism without jingle. He'll tell us what it is. I'm not going to read all this. But Marty's joining us live on Good Morning New Hampshire, the Pulse of Nature. Marty, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jack.
Tell us a little bit about you before we talk about the book. I got briefed yesterday by Ginger about some of the activities you do nationally, and I thank you for what you do. It's very important. I'd love to plug you in once a month on my show, but tell us a little about you.
Yeah, so I'm originally from South Dakota. I live in New Hampshire now, and shortly after high school, I joined the Army. Ended up making it into the 75th Ranger Regiment, where I did three deployments to Iraq, two to Afghanistan, and then did a short stint as a recruiter after that before I got out. And, a lot of things happened in between there, but eventually found my way into conflict journalism and ended up going back to Iraq, back to Afghanistan, over to Ukraine, doing all that sort of stuff. Got a couple books. The latest one is Send Me the True Story of a Mother War about Senior Chief Petty Officer Shannon Kent.
Well, I kind of love it, Marty, how you just threw in 75th Rangers and what, three deployments. Just threw that in there, Marty. Thank you.
Yeah.
I like the humility. But seriously, thank you for your service. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, so Shannon Kent, really unique person in the military. She joined the Navy shortly after 9/11. Both her dad and her uncle were 9/11 first responders and said, hey, you know, not in my city, and, went to go do something about it. So she joined, you know, at that time there was a bar on women in combat roles to include special operations. So she did kind of the next best thing that she could think of, which was to go leverage her ability with languages and became a cryptological technician linguist in the Navy. quickly after she got done with language school, she ended up volunteering to go to Iraq instead of sitting in kind of the windowless office that they stuck her in initially after her training. And that volunteering to go to Iraq ended up with her being attached to a SEAL team over there. And that kind of changed the entire trajectory of her career. But by the time it was all said and done, you know, she was killed in Syria in January 16th, 2019. She had transcended to the very highest levels of special operations. I mean, she did 4 combat deployments before women were even allowed in combat roles. Spoke 5 languages, multiple dialects, 9 total military deployments, 5 of them combat deployments, mother of 2, cancer survivor, marathon runner, you name
Unbelievable.
I mean, I could go on for another 5 minutes just on all the titles she has held.
Unbelievable story of human perseverance and intelligence. Where was she from originally, Marty?
She was up just kind of up in the upper Hudson Valley area, Hudson River Valley area there.
What drew her to service? I'm just curious. Was it in her family or what drew her?
Well, yeah, like I said, her dad and her brother were both 9/11 first responders down at Ground Zero.
Okay.
And I think that really kind of changed her outlook on life. So I think she would have ended up in service either way, but both, and her younger brother also. He joined the Marine Corps. She joined the Navy. They both went to combat multiple times. Really very patriotic family.
Tell me a little bit about what brought you to New Hampshire, and you're editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose, a military news and culture publication, and maybe and a former Army Ranger, 75th, but maybe that's what, maybe that was an offshoot of you becoming a conflict reporter after you served those deployments. Tell us a little bit about Task and Purpose and, you know, the mission there.
Yeah, so Task and Purpose was founded by a Marine back in 2014, so this is actually our 10th year in publication, and we reach millions of people a month, mostly with a focus on active duty, reserve, and guard service members, as well as veterans. And we're reporting the news. We're doing good news stories about the culture of the military and veterans, and really just trying to make sure that we're a voice for that. I would call it the ground level service member, right? Like, we're less concerned about what's going on in the halls, you know, with generals and things like that. We want to know and advocate for what's going on at the ground level, that soldier in the foxhole, that sailor on a ship, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you to New Hampshire to live?
While I was in the Army, I met my wife was going to college down in Georgia, and she's originally from Massachusetts. And so we met. I just happened to be stationed in the same place she was going to college. We met, got married, and then eventually, as we started to have kids, we said, hey, let's go get back up closer to family. And I was traveling all the time, right, doing the conflict reporting thing. So it was important to have her close to family, and we really liked the Seacoast area of New Hampshire and said, hey, why don't we do that? That puts us close to family, and we get to be near the ocean, near the forest, the mountains, everything that New Hampshire has to offer, we just loved.
And Marty, you did the right thing. You want to live here, not Massachusetts. Good move, good move, Marty. Very good move, Marty. You're a Ranger. Good move. You got that one figured out.
We love it.
I'm just. I wish Mass was doing a better job prioritizing veterans on the shelter side and homelessness versus undocumented migrant folks. But that's another story for another day. Hey, Marty, real quickly, the book Send Me, The True Story of a Mother at War. And that's available pretty much anywhere. I know William Morrow Publications, but pretty much Amazon, you name it, right? Send Me?
Yeah. Everywhere books are available, either online or in person. I know I stopped into the Barnes & Noble there in Portsmouth, or Newington, I think it's technically. They had a couple copies in on the shelves there. It's anywhere books are sold, really. It should be available. And it's ebook, audio, the physical hardcover, whatever you want.
Well, listen, Ginger is great. She connected us. I've been planning tomorrow, so I'm a little bit behind. I wanted to get you on sooner, so thanks for joining us. If people want to follow up with you on terms of Task and Purpose or anything else, what's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, definitely check out our stories on taskandpurpose.com. And then, you know, I'm on all the social media platforms. It's just my name, Marty Scolvin Jr. And, but definitely go check out the book.
Well, listen, I appreciate that. Would love to get you in. I know it's short notice, but we're at 12 hours tomorrow. And I don't know if you're in New Hampshire, but you're welcome to come in here for a segment or two with me in studio tomorrow afternoon if you want. Or if it works out, just have your folks touch base with mine and we'll have you in here. If not, I'd love to get you back in on the show soon.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm out of town right now talking to some active duty service members about the book, so I won't be back quite then, but definitely, you know, I live in the area, so let's make sure we make this a regular thing.
I would love to. Thanks for your support on the veterans, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Jack.
The Granite State's number one streaming news talk station. This is the Pulse of New Hampshire. Good morning, New Hampshire, powered by Sig Sauer. Now, back to Jack Heath on the Pulse of New Hampshire.
All right, Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio national correspondent, joining us live, talking about basically the effort that China's trying to do on the retail side to kind of bump Amazon to the curve, I guess. I don't know if it's going to happen. Take it away, Aaron.
Yeah, they're doing their very best. Is it working? That remains to be seen. So Temu, which is the second most popular shopping app here in the U.S., is actually shifting strategies because of what's happening with TikTok. So they're owned, Temu, by Chinese e-commerce giant PDD Holdings, and they want to limit their risk. So they're looking for other areas of growth, like Europe, like Africa, basically places and governments that haven't said, we want to ban anything under the Chinese government, much like they're going to do with TikTok, likely, unless ByteDance, their parent company, sells to a U.S.-based company. They say they don't want to do that. They're not interested. So we might not see TikTok in about a year's time. This has a profound impact on essentially what can operate here if it's a Chinese company. And while you've seen incredible lobbying efforts by TikTok, ByteDance, and also by Shein, which is fast fashion, Temu so far hasn't invested a dollar in lobbying. They're like, no, what? We're just going to be happy in second place and continue to expand elsewhere.
Interesting. Well, good stuff, Aaron. Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Joe Guyton, the Guyton Group, they're conveniently located over at Pease International Trade Port in Portsmouth. We'll tell you how you can contact them, and we're talking how to live, and welcome back to living abundantly, and I think smartly, and plan for things a little bit. We don't seem to do that enough, especially retirement. Joe Guyton joining us back, and Joe, according to a recent study I was checking out, and I think this is probably understated, just about half of people 60 and over years old feel financially prepared for retirement, and that's sobering. I think that number may be high, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Always nice to chat with you. Yes, I think that number may be a little high, and it's certainly frightening to think that half of people out there are financially unprepared to retire, to say nothing of the emotional aspects of it. That means they either aren't saving, aren't planning, or maybe a little bit of both.
You know, Joe, and of course, inflation and everything being so expensive and a lack of affordable housing doesn't make it much easier, does it?
Makes it an even greater challenge. Fortunately, most people who are preparing to retire already have their housing aspect of their planning down, and they may even be in the position where they can downsize a house, harvest some equity to help supplement their retirement plan. But certainly for people on the other end of the scale, the spectrum, who are just starting out and just starting to plan, put their financial plan together, affordable housing is certainly an issue.
How about how do you know, it's that question, how much money is enough? Because that number is going up, not down.
Well, last time we were chatting, we talked about people who are how they're living a lot longer now than they were 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's not the least bit unusual today for people to live to be 100 or more, meaning they may be retired for almost as long as they worked to begin with. Longer life expectancies mean people will need more money for retirement, which leaves them at risk of outliving their asset base because they don't save enough. Now, they might have guaranteed payments like a pension or Social Security, but that may not be enough to sustain their living needs if their asset base itself has been diminished because they consumed it. So people need to keep in mind that the average 401k balance, because that's the biggest chunk of a lot of people's retirement plan, mm-hmm. May not be enough to allow you to maintain your preferred lifestyle. If you live a long time, you may need to save more money. You may need to retire later. You may need to think about a part-time job or implement a combination of these things. And most certainly, if you own a business, you want to plan an exit strategy that allows for ongoing income and you want to make sure that that liquidity event of your business is impactful enough to help sustain your lifestyle. You know, this, Jack, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
It's essential to work with a financial professional to help determine what will work best for you.
Yeah, it's like we have doctors for everything else. Why would, you know, what about, you said earlier, Joe Guyton, Guyton Group, earlier talking about don't make macro assumptions about how much money you need for retirement. What does that mean?
Exactly. You can't just think to yourself, well, I got $1 million, I'll be fine. You have to consider inflation, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, and many other risks. And in addition to those risks, you have to take a look at your regular expenses. You have to anticipate extra expenses in retirement, like travel, medical bills, home repairs, gifts to your children, college payments, all those sorts of things. So there's no magic number that works for everyone. Some experts say that people will need 70 to 90% of their pre-retirement income to retire comfortably. And that might be a good rule of thumb, but other people advise you should have 12 times your pre-retirement salary, which is just another way to say the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you consider how much money to set as your retirement goal, you need to account for not just your expenses and whether or not you'll have new expenses. You have to account for longevity risk, which is living a long time. And as we noted earlier, people are living a lot longer now.
Mm-hmm.
And also something called sequence of market return risk and its impact on your first few years of retirement. Both of those, longevity risk and sequence of return, are impossible to predict, because no one knows how long they'll live, and market returns are affected by events generally beyond our control.
Yeah, especially these days. Joe, you've talked in the past. I mean, what are the thoughts here? And you also, what else? And also, you talk about the importance of financial planning, and I think that's more relevant here than ever, right?
Yes. It's very important to ask the right questions. For instance, when do you want to retire? If you know you want to retire early, you'll need more savings to cover your longer retirement. Next question, how much do you need do you expect to spend in retirement? What are your bills and what's your lifestyle look like? And that'll be impacted by the fact that oftentimes people spend more money initially in retirement because they're not working as much. Consider also your expected lifestyle as part of that. If you'll spend more money on traveling, you know, taking flying lessons, pursuing your hobbies versus staying at home and not doing as much, then you will need to have more money, particularly, as I say, if you plan to add some new hobbies that are costly. Another question to ask is, after you retire from your primary career, will you have a next chapter, a re-career with a post-retirement job? Maybe something you always wanted to do but never did, that would supplement your income. And the answers to these and other important questions certainly help determine how much you'll need to save initially for retirement.
And more people are getting those post, second, and third careers, even if it's part-time, to keep the money coming. And, Joe, you talk a lot about financial planning. Maybe you can touch upon that briefly. And also, what happens if things aren't going as smoothly as a plan goes? Because obviously life can rock plans as much as you plan, right?
Definitely. So a couple of answers there. It's certainly important to take a look at the big picture relative to financial planning. View all of your goals and assess your overall situation. And it often helps to work with an expert that provides comprehensive integrated solutions, which also consider your estate planning, your business exit planning, very important for our listeners who own businesses,
mm-hmm.
As well as their retirement income planning. And you mentioned it earlier, there are doctors for everything. You know, when you get on the airplane, you don't look at the pilot who often greets you and tell him, you know, you think you'll fly the plane. You let somebody else help. Because there's knowledge there that you may not have considered. So when you get to retirement, your asset base and net worth should be at their highest point. You want to discuss key points with an advisor, including such things as, do I have enough money? How is the money positioned? Who controls it? Is it a pension? Is it Social Security?
Right.
How does my business fit in? Am I selling it out to my family? And, you know, with people with multiple accounts, the key question is which account should you use first? Like, what's the order of that? And that's one of the biggest questions we get when we meet new people. I've got all these assets. You know, how do I get an income out of them? And the right advisor can help you figure all that out. And so then you also asked about, you know, if you're veering off course, how do you right the ship? Well, here again, you work with a trusted advisor to figure out the best solutions, the best corrective actions. And that involves gathering a summary of assets and expenses. It's very important here to run projections. We do that for people all the time. We build models for them. Because those projections tell you where you are relative to your goals. And if you're short of meeting those numbers, again, you can take corrective actions such as increasing your savings, reducing expenses. A good example of that is downsizing a home. And again, to your point, affordable housing, it's easy nowadays to harvest equity from a home. And very important, again, if you own a business, you might want to set up a pension plan to increase your deductible savings. And a plan like that might also make it easier for you to retain your employees, who are a lot harder to find in this environment.
Joe, we only got a minute here. And sometimes downsizing a home, it used to be easier. Today, it's like, where do you move to? Everything's almost as expensive as the one you're leaving. Real quickly, expenses might be something people miss when they worry about how much money. They might underestimate expenses, even healthcare expenses, right?
Yes, and again, that's another great question and one I hear all the time. Certain expenses like mortgage on your home and maybe work-related commuting might decrease when you retire. However, some other expenses, such as medical expenses in particular, is a big one. But also travel, entertainment may increase, in your retirement. And there are studies out there that have shown that, you know, older couples might need as much as $185,000 to $385,000 for medical expenses alone in their retirement, depending on how their Medicare coverage is. And, you know, with, again, medical inflation, that's an amount that's likely to increase over time. And again, I say it all the time, probably sound like a broken record. It's all part of the planning process to take a look at these things and account for what you expect, account for what you have, and test your model out to see how sensitive it is relative to unexpected events. Because if you do that in advance, again, particularly if you own a business, I tell people that own businesses, you need to start planning 5 to 7 years before you're ready to exit in order to make sure that all the pieces are in place, that, you know, you've taken money out of your business, which is something people don't think of. They put their money back into the business, and that increases the amount they need to get as a liquidity event when they go to retire. If you have the money, you know, on your own personal balance sheet, you don't have to get the last dollar for the business. So those are all things that are worth speaking about.
Always wealth of information. Thank you so much, Joe Guyton. You can contact the office, 603-766-9200, 766-9200. Joe Guyton, G-U-Y-T-O-N. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Jack. Always a pleasure. Have a good day.
Mike Cody is the editor of New Hampshire Group, Yankee Publishing, which is New Hampshire Magazine, New Hampshire Business Review. Talking about a real estate conference, but how it can tie into the Department of Defense as well in terms of a subject after the real estate conference. But we just had Joe Guyton on talking about people wanting to downsize their homes, maybe getting older, put some money away, but everything they want to downsize to, Mike Cody, cost as much, if not more. So talk about the real estate conference.
Yeah, my wife and I have a similar conversation. She wants to move into, you know, a condo where we don't have to do anything. Like, well, it's probably not the best time for that, but we're still looking. Yeah, so Dean Kamen's Army Project, the Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute. There was a conference last week at DECA, and what's the news that came out of that conference, Dean Kamen just kind of casually mentioned that the Department of Defense has committed another $100 million over 10 years for the project. If you remember, several years ago, there was an initial investment of $80 million and a couple of other major funding rounds in between. But the backstory is that this was a conference aimed at real estate people. So you had real estate professionals. The company that put the conference on was Fulcrum Construction Management, and it was hosted by the New England Real Estate Journal. So that tells you where this is going. Really one of the biggest problems for the growth of this project is housing. You know, housing and workforce development, which go hand in hand. And you know, Dean Kamen was talking to a bunch of real estate professionals saying, I hope you guys are good at what you do. You need to develop the infrastructure, because in order for this project to grow and to bring young people here who want, you know, want to come to a place that has the amenities, particularly a place to live, that's what we need. And Manchester has a lot going on, a lot of downtown, you know, office towers becoming apartments, a lot of people moving downtown, but that's the kind of energy you need to get people to come here and build this. There's a race, you know, with Texas and California and other places that have more tax credits and, you know, more resources than New Hampshire.
Hey, real quick, can I come back to the real quickly on the Army side and the investment with the Pentagon for the next 10 years, you said? And years ago I toured when I think it was one of the folks from Dyn was still there working with getting that going. Might have been Greg. I can't remember which one. But
yeah, it was Greg Chenoweth, I believe.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I guess my question is, when they do this, and I'm not questioning anything, but I know it's incubation, it's development. I mean, to make basically synthetic eyes or, you know, skin mimicking skin tissue and all that, it takes time. It's very delicate, but it's, you know, high-end stuff. So it's a lot of different folks trying. But this has been going for a while. When Dean Kamen's group gets this grant, how is that policed, if you will? In other words, how does that $100 million, how's it spent? How does it go? What's the oversight process? I was just curious.
Well, I know that there's $50 million committed over 5 years. That was from Maureen Toohey, who's Army's Deputy Executive Director. The next 5 years, it's an annual, you know, option to renew the additional $10 million. And yeah, there's certainly, when there's tax funds involved, you know, that transparency is a big issue. And I think the more money they get, the more scrutiny there's going to be there. But there's also a match involved. The initial $80 million that the Department of Defense gave to this project several years ago involved coming up with local funding, other funding sources. So there was a lot of in-kind, more than, I think, $230 million from universities and the medical groups and companies, and there's a similar issue with this particular project. But yeah, there's a lot of money here, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more paperwork to be filled, a lot more scrutiny as this goes forward.
Mike Cody on a nice Tuesday. Enjoy the milder temperatures. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Jack. Take care.
Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent, joining us. Good morning, Rory.
Hey, Jack. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, and, you know, by some estimates, I think we're short about 5 million housing units nationwide. So it's been something that's been a developing problem since the Great Recession, and we still haven't figured it out.
Well, available housing is one thing, but wow, the ones we have, holy mackerel, and just a rent. You know, it's just really tough with inflation and people on fixed incomes. I think that's the biggest story. I don't know what you're going to update us on something else, but the biggest story in the economy, no one's talking about, is everything is so darn expensive.
Right.
That a lot of people, as we get older as a society, don't have as many income sources, you know, coming in. With everything so expensive, and then you add the housing costs keep going up, they're running out of money the second week of a four-week, you know, pay period where they might get paid once or twice. They're running out of money the second week of the month.
Well, right. And look, it's great if you own the home and you've seen the value soar in the past 5 or 10 years. But if you're trying to get into the marketplace, it's incredibly difficult. And then you can't, you know, if you are in the house for 10 years, you can't get out of that mortgage because it's at 2.5% or 3%. You don't want to.
Right.
And then there's nowhere to go because the next house you'd want to buy is also out of your price range. So a lot of people actually feel stuck in their current circumstance.
Well, that's a good point. If you want to cash out and you can sell your house, the problem is that you can't move adjacently because nothing's less expensive, you know, cheaper. All right, Rory, what do you have for us this morning?
Just a quick look then at this, where people who are just starting their careers are moving to. This sort of goes in line with that. The best cities for starting your career. New York is actually dead last out of 182. Because of the expense and the awful commute and things like that. Athens, Georgia comes in top of the list this time around. I'm looking for Nashua, New Hampshire comes in at 54. Manchester, 61. Pretty good rankings out of 182.
Interesting. And look at New York's. How's that working for you? You're going to love it here. All right. Thank you, Rory.
Thanks, Jack.
All right, Tom Furtado at Catch Housing in our studios. Tom, thanks for being patient. You got in a little bit early on a nice balmy Tuesday. How are you?
Very well, Jack. How are you doing? Thanks for having me here.
Well, you know what? You've, as I said, we five times this morning, we've referenced affordable housing and the lack of it. And it's probably one of the top public policy issues, challenges that we have here locally.
It certainly is. It's finally getting the press that it needs. There is a huge shortage, not only nationally, as Rory mentioned, but here in New Hampshire.
What I like about what you're doing, we're going to talk about your residential services, but let's go back a little bit because you're in studio. You're nice. We have time. Website, the mission of Catch, but you're doing something about it. You're not just talking about it. You're doing something about it.
We're certainly trying. We have a great staff that works hard every day at it. Catch has been in existence since 1989, and so it's been 30-plus years of developing affordable and workforce housing in and around Merrimack County. So we currently have about 400 apartment units of affordable housing here in Merrimack and trying to build as many as we can. Quick plug for our new project, which is on Sheep Davis Road, Route 106 here in Concord. That's going to be 48 units of affordable and workforce housing, and those will be ready to go around January 1.
Tom, can you break down what affordable and workforce housing means, who qualifies, how you base the metrics of a monthly payment, describe the housing? Can you give us some details here?
Sure. Just this may be a shock, but everything is dictated by HUD and the government. So we use the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program to fund the development and construction of these developments. And then the individuals who, and individuals and family who qualify to rent these apartments, it's all based on the percentage income of the area median income. And I can tell you that the area median income here in Merrimack County is about $115,000 right now. So an individual who makes 60 or 50% of that area median income qualifies for one of our affordable housing units.
So if I'm a new teacher in the area, new police officer, new firefighter, say my all-in gross pay with overtime's $75,000-$80,000, this might be something I should look at.
Absolutely. So that $75,000 or $80,000, if it's it would not qualify if you're a single person, but if you have a spouse and maybe one child, absolutely, that qualifies for one of our apartments under the HUD program.
Interesting. All right. So, and how do you, what's the process of, like you mentioned the new, your new development, 40 plus units. How's the, what's the process of applying, if you will? Is it arduous? Is there a lot to it? How do you do it?
Well, there is some detail needed, but it's really not that difficult. You just go to our website, catchhousing.org. You can make your way through it for an application, and then obviously there's some income verification, and we do things like criminal background checks. We don't allow felons into our developments. It makes it unsafe, and that's not what we're trying to do. So catchhousing.org, walk your way through the application process, and we can get you in one of the apartments.
Interesting. All right, so let's talk about the residential services program. What's that all about?
Yeah, so we have on staff several what we call resident service coordinators. And what they do, Jack, is they're really there to help our residents. We don't provide any services, so to speak, but we help our residents find those services that they might need. For example, we will help direct them to places like the Community Action Program of Belknap and Merrimack County, where they can get some utility cost assistance or rent assistance. Department of Health and Human Services, things like that. And our resident service coordinators, they're really there to help. So they help them fill out the paperwork if it's a little confusing or difficult. So we do whatever we need to help our residents succeed in this society.
Interesting. And how can people get involved to help you? And what are you looking for to grow Catch? Because I know we're Capital Region, but you'll go outside the How can people help more on the residential services? Maybe there's a service they can provide. All right, tell us how we can help you.
Well, absolutely. We're always looking for volunteers to help us in and around our developments. And as far as other agencies, we would love to have them reach out to us through our website, catchhousing.org, and offer up their services and coordinate with our resident service coordinators and put them in touch with our residents who may be in need.
Tom, before I let you go, what if there's a developer, landowner, you know, sorry, a apartment owner who they say, you know, I might have some housing here. I should maybe do something differently with make it more affordable to help my community. Can they reach out to you and get some expertise and kind of talk to you?
Absolutely. We are happy to work with anyone who's interested in doing that. We can do some consulting on the real estate side and help them get through the process of creating affordable housing.
Now, how long, by the way, before I let you go, how long have you been here with Catch? How long have you been doing this?
I've been with Catch a little over 7 years now.
What brought you to it?
Well, it was just the, I've been doing real estate development for a long time, and this was really a way to do it that had a mission and a purpose. And it's great to see a new development, a new young family get into a very safe and affordable home.
You know what? I appreciate it, Tom. And if people want to learn more, go to the website?
Catchhousing.org.
Catchhousing.org, including the residential services. If you apply, if you qualify me for one of these new units, check it out, please. It might alleviate some stress in your life. And it's quality. It's good. It's safe. Tom, before I let you go, we're busy. Kind of, I'm focused on tomorrow. I got a 12-hour broadcast day for veterans. But what I'd like to do is after we get through Memorial Day and take a breath is maybe talk with you. I'm just talking to you now on air, but having a kind of a on the record, maybe in, I think, June, it feels right. Maybe we should dedicate one of my morning shows in studio here. You know, we go 3 hours and you bring in other stakeholders in the affordable housing, get the governor on, and we can get a lot of people on to really raise awareness on this affordable housing and try and come up with more solutions out there. I could do a special program on this.
That would be great. Absolutely interested in something like that. So.